Good evening, and welcome to What a World, celebrating diversity and loving it. This is Nevin Campanella bringing you a radio talk show that has no limits and bows to no one. From this microphone, we bring you guests who will lead you across those shadowy plains of forbidden knowledge. And tonight, that forbidden knowledge will be revealed by our guest, Dr. Christopher Holmes. He will explore with us the enigmas of human consciousness. But before we get to Dr. Holmes, let's take a look at this date of October 9th in history. In the year 1582, due to the implementation of the Gregorian calendar, this date just does not exist in the year 1582 in Italy, Poland, Portugal, and Spain. The Gregorian calendar was devised because this mean year in the Julian calendar was a little too long, causing the vernal equinox to slowly drift earlier in the calendar year. Well, put simply, folks, all they were really trying to do was nail down the date of March 21st for being the first day of spring. Ever hear of a conflagration?
What it means is a very intense and uncontrolled fire. Well, the great conflagration of Chicago was brought under control on October 9th, 1871. What else happened on this day? A famous person, British musician and songwriter, John Lennon, was born on this day. And for those of you who have followed his career, he was murdered by David Chapman on December 8th, 1980. What's going on in the news? A sad, sad time in India and Pakistan. The death toll is now over 20,000, and the UN said that there's going to be possibly 2.5 million people who are going to need shelter. They're yelling and screaming for 200,000 winterized tents. I have no way of sending a tent, but I and you can certainly send our prayers. And for those of you who follow earthquake predictions, Charlotte King predicted this one, a form of hidden knowledge that will soon have a permanent place on What a World Radio. And what hidden knowledge will be uncovered tonight on What a World Radio? It is the mysteries of consciousness and the heart. Brought to us by Dr. Christopher Holmes of Ottawa, Canada. Tonight he will introduce us to zero-point dynamics in the exploration of science of the soul. Christopher Holmes was born in England on October 7th, 1949, and raised in Ontario, Canada. He graduated with a BA from Carleton University, Ottawa, in 1971, and a PhD in clinical psychology from the University of Waterloo in 1978. He taught at York University, Downsview, Ontario, over an 11-year period, and I understand there is some controversy over his investigations of mystical and spiritual psychology. We'll get into that a little bit with him. He co-founded with Anita Mitra three centers, the Institute for Mystical and Spiritual Science, the Rainbow Center in Toronto, and Zero Point in the Ottawa Valley. Chris has worked as a forensic psychologist for 12 years with young offenders at Blue Water Youth Center and with adult offenders at Rideau Correctional and Treatment Center, Merrickville. In 2003, he left the Ontario Ministry of Corrections to further his research, writing, and teaching. Hi, Christopher. Welcome to What a World.
Good evening, Nevin. Thanks for the invitation to join What a World.
Oh, you're more than welcome, Christopher. Why don't you give us a little bit about who you are? Who is Christopher Holmes without the social trappings of university degrees? I did see a picture of you with your five children on the website. Tell us a little bit about yourself and your family life.
I have been married twice and have five children and separated at this time and have loving relationships with my children. And, you know, I've kind of lived by myself and pursue my zero-point studies at this time and working up my writing and had a very rich life.
You're one of the few professionals that is actually willing to demonstrate themselves as human, and by that I mean by actually putting a picture of your family on the website. I think that's admirable, and it demonstrates your yourself as being a very family-oriented and personal individual. Before we go any further into the actual interview, Christopher, how can someone get a copy of your publications, your books? What must they do? Where do they go on the web to secure those things?
Yes, to www.zeropoint.ca. And ZeroPoint is spelt out like Z-E-R-O-P-O-I-N-T. And it's easiest to, you can get all the information on my website for the different books I've published.
You also have an emailing list. Do the people go to the same place to secure that, or is there other place they...
If they go to my site, they can click on a link there or send me an email, and I'll put them on my email list to keep them updated of new articles or books I produce or talks I give in Canada or the States.
Wonderful. Now, you recently conducted an internet survey of Canadian university psychology departments. What was the purpose of the survey? What motivated you to conduct it?
Okay, to give a little bit of history, it's almost 30 years ago I was a graduate student in psychology, interested in the phenomena of human consciousness. And for the last 30 years, I've pursued that studies both within modern Western psychology, but also studying widely in the mystical and spiritual traditions of both Eastern and Western, of East and West. So I've become, in a way, a specialist in mystical and spiritual psychology, but my experience within academia has been that these areas are completely ignored within the mainstream of psychology as a modern science. So I did an internet survey of 13 universities across country to see how many professors and courses were offered in any of these areas related to psychology of the soul or psychology of consciousness or psychical studies. And what I found, out of almost 600 professors in Canada, there was not a single professor offering expertise in this area. There was not a single graduate course, and there was only four secondary courses at one university offered in these areas, which to me is a profoundly sad commentary on modern educational system, that these most important areas of the psychology of the science of the soul is completely ignored in modern times.
I can understand it. I don't know if you're aware, Christopher, I spent myself 25 years in clinical psych. I have a PhD. And did a lot of work in mental health centers and state hospitals. But going back in time, if you go back to the university systems 30, 35 years ago, I mean, it was so behaviorally oriented. I'm not at all surprised.
No.
At what you're finding out. And there's a, you made a notation on your website, and you entitled it The Strange Case of Professor Z. Does that case of Professor Z have anything to do with this survey? Did that have any motivation for it?
Well, that goes back. I was a university professor for 12 years in Toronto at York University. And through that time, my work became very, very popular among students who worked and studied with me. But then I was denied tenure and had a case that went on. It was drawn out over 7-8 years. Where they were trying to denied me tenure, and eventually I left the university. But there had been wide student protest about this dismissal, and from the student government who petitioned the Ontario government and the president and everyone, that students wanted to be exposed to these alternative viewpoints, but there's that intolerance within academia to these types of investigations. As you say, psychology was primarily behavioristic up until the 50s or 60s, and now the last 30 years has been cognitive behavioral. So there isn't a place in modern psychology generally for looking at the paranormal or psychical phenomena.
I'm not sure there's much of a difference between behavioral and cognitive. All cognitive is a rehash of behavioral, but doing it inside someone's head.
It's much the same philosophy, yes. In a way, it's not a significantly new paradigm.
No, not at all, especially when you start using elastic bands around someone's wrist to stop a particular thought. I mean, we're talking about behavioral psychology again. Do you think that someone today would run into the same thing you did 30 years ago, or would it be different today?
Well, I think it's absolutely the same as it was. I mean, that's what my internet survey showed, is no one has expertise. Out of 600 professors, no one has any expertise in the area, and there's no opportunities for students to study in the area. See, it becomes more of an issue even in modern times, because the primary issue in modern psychology is the issue of human consciousness, and that's the fundamental enigma that no one can account for. What is consciousness, and how is it produced, and so on?
Yeah, we're going to get into that. You're jumping the gun a little bit.
Okay.
In attempting to come up with some direction to this interview, I became very aware of how extremely difficult it would be to try to attempt to untangle some of the major writings that you have on your website, especially those considering the mysteries of the human consciousness. You know, and I could sit here as a talk show host and just ask you a few simple questions and let you ramble on off into wherever, but I don't want to do that tonight.
Okay.
I would like to be able to give the audience some real insight into how they could understand some of the terminology within your website. So I'm going to first explore some of the general nature of your work as defined by the Zero Point Institute. Then we'll get on to a general discussion of human consciousness as a product of heart rather than the brain. And if time allows, and this is a personal interest of mine, I'd like to get into your article, Microcom, Macrocom, which seems to be primarily an attempt to explain the cabal. So given where I want to go, let's first start with what is the Zero Point Institute. On your website, Christopher, you state, quote, Zero Point, as an institute of mystical and spiritual science, is dedicated to the investigation of the origins of human consciousness and the multidimensional reality or nature of reality. Now, that's a bit of a heavy statement to discuss in a one-hour talk show, so let's start with some sort of definition of human consciousness. In layman's terms, Christopher, what is it, and do other life forms such as dogs or plants have it?
I would define consciousness as the inner awareness of being. In the general sense, I would begin with the simplest way. It's that inner awareness of being. And
okay.
That does exist. I believe that does exist in other animals, yes.
Let's bring it one step further. If you say it exists in other forms of animals, can we include plant life in that?
Well, it's not even a subject I've really thought out. But see, in a way, I believe that there is a form of absolute consciousness that permeates all things. So at some fundamental low level of reality, consciousness pervades all things. I don't believe
There is evidence to suggest that plant life does react.
Yeah.
To us. So.
Oh, and
you know,
I believe that. I believe in the emotional and psychical sensitivity of plants.
Okay, a key word in the Zero Point is origins. Now that suggests a beginning point. And of course that also implies a point of not being. If you have a beginning point, there's an implication of not being. In your opinion, is our self-awareness, our personal awareness of self, infinite? Or was there a point of non-existence for each person's self-awareness?
I think there's a point of non-awareness, and it emerges into existence, just as our universe at one point was non-existent and then emerged in from a point source, a singularity, out of the quantum vacuum. Just as our universe emerges from a point source out of the quantum vacuum, I believe human beings have zero-point origins out of the quantum vacuum, that we can't emerge within without from the deep dimensions of space.
Well, if we stick with the word zero, in terms of how most people are familiar with it, such as an algebraic expression or ratio measurement, we definitely get to a point where nothing exists, and that's what I was wondering in terms of how you yourself felt about it. So my conclusion at this point from your writing is that you believe, in fact, that at one point self-awareness was not there and somehow created by something, or was it self-created?
I would say it was more created by something. I believe the individual soul emerges out of what you might call the super soul. In the Vedas, they talk about the Supreme Lord throwing off sparks. Each of those sparks is like a divine spark, and that one of those is within each human being, and those are thrown off, and they're of the same quality of the super soul, but there's that individual God spark within each human being.
The term God spark, I've heard that before. Where does that come from?
I read it in Shirley MacLaine years ago in Going Within, and she said, "Oh, the most important belief of the New Age is that everyone has a God spark within them." And she was saying we need the subconsciousness. And when I thought of it, oh, a God spark. And then as I studied the mystical literature, exploring that concept of there being a divine spark or a spiritual spark within a human being. And then that led me to all the study of these esoteric teachings, like the Vedic teachings of India and Kabbalah and Blavatsky and other teachings, to explore that idea of there being a divine point source emanation within the human being.
There are a lot of people that I've run into who kind of put down the whole Shirley MacLaine aspect with the age, and yet many of us got our start from her books. It wasn't until I think it was either Out on a Limb or Dancing in Light. I can't remember which one. One of those two books is which kind of got me started into this whole realm. Now, Christopher, there's a couple of terms that you use that I got a little confused about because you bracket them together when you, especially the term within without, and that's a little bit hard to digest. Can you give us some kind of understanding about how you're using that?
Okay, that's very subtle and complex. In a way, think for a moment. Think of something growing from a seed state. Like a human being, when they're born, a fertilized ovum is so small, it's barely visible. It's in a way, a zero point. It looks like a point source. Okay, and then the growth of a human being, in a sense, is within without from that small point source. So it kind of grows into a full human being from a point source. So in a way, things grow within without from point sources. But also within is higher dimensional space, and that produces what is manifest without in the external world. So I'm really saying there are these deeper dimensions of existence within which underlie what appears to us as manifest in the world. So processes in life are governed in a way within without.
That's, believe me, that's extremely difficult to digest in just a cursory review of the articles. And I would suggest to the audience out there, to really gain a further understanding of this, please do purchase Dr. Holmes' books, because this is not a subject, folks, that you can just digest like the headline news. Dr. Holmes is digging extremely, extremely deep, and in order to understand it, you're going to have to work. This is not going to come easy. I will tell you this, it's well worth the effort. Because when you're finished, you will have a much better understanding of your own existence. Christopher, in a lot of your writing, you keep talking about Madame H.P. Blavatsky. Who was she? And how did her writing have such an influence in the development of Zero Point?
H.P. Blavatsky lived mainly in the 19th century and died, I think, 1889. But she published The Secret Doctrine in 1888. And she's often regarded as the grandmother of modern occultism. And she explained The Secret Doctrine, which dealt with the creation of the universe and the evolution of humankind. So in terms of my, I studied the secret doctrine and understood her concepts about zero-point origins and higher dimensions, and then I've related that to the study of modern physics. So a lot of my work, I took the concept of zero-point from Madame Blavatsky, and then I've studied it in physics as well.
Well, that's not a name you're going to run across in Psych 101, Christopher. How did you manage to... I fully understand your background, your education, and all the courses you went through, and never once would that name ever come up. How did you get to it? I mean, how did you manage to leave that the best word, folks, is sterile academic area, and I know it's sterile. I taught at two universities. How did you leave that to find her?
Okay, I guess it was that came about 10 years into my studies of mystical teachings. You see, I was a psychologist interested in psychotherapy, and that involves making the unconscious conscious. But Western views of consciousness are mainly dualistic, like conscious and unconscious. And I became concerned, well, how about higher states of consciousness? What is self-consciousness? What is cosmic consciousness? Okay, what is God consciousness? So I became interested in higher states of consciousness. Now, those subjects are completely ignored in the mainstream of Western psychology. So that's what led me to study yogic Vedic teachings, Tibetan Buddhism, Blavatsky, and all these mystics who had attained higher levels of self-realization. So, all those people, they're not taught in the universities. You see, that's what I say is the problem.
Now, you'd have to go into philosophy courses themselves, and I'm not even sure at a university you would find it. Did you ever get a chance to travel to the Far East to study some of these esoteric subjects?
No, I haven't, and not yet.
That's a goal we both have, Christopher. You know, I don't know how I would make it. You know, if it cost a nickel to go around the world, I'd have to stay right here. But if you ever come up with a grant, I'd be more than willing to travel with you.
Okay, that'd be fun.
Yeah, it would. It really would. Let's get to the origin of consciousness. Now, your particular point of view is very, very different than what people are going to usually find. Because what you're saying, and there are others who say it, is that the point of consciousness is from the heart rather than the brain. Now, most of us assume that the brain is the connection between self-realization and the human body. But you and others like the Dalai Lama have suggested this connection comes from the heart. Would you explain the heart doctrine specifically for us?
Okay, and it's very useful to define first what I call the head doctrine, which is the dogma, I would call it, that's established in modern science. And that is the assumption that the material brain produces consciousness. But no one can explain what the consciousness is or how it's produced by the brain. Okay. Now, what I'm doing is pointing out that whereas we assume in modern science the brain produces consciousness, really there's no evidence for it, and all the mystics from all the different religious traditions and all basic esoteric spiritual teachings say that consciousness and I originates from within the heart. And the process in mysticism of self-realization is described as the dissolution of the false mind into the lotus of the heart, that your heart is actually a center that can open, and you want to learn to live in your heart center, because that's the level of your self, your deeper self, whereas your mind is more the focus of the ego, the personality nature. So it's bringing consciousness from the mind into the heart. That's called self-realization.
Is this where the comments come from? I've had even the station manager, Don Newsom, say to me, Nevin, you got to think with your heart, not your brain. Is that what this is referring to?
Yes, yeah, exactly. I would say people have intuitive knowledge, and it's evident even in our language. Like if I say to you, speak from the heart, okay, that means I get to the essence of something. Don't speak off the top of your head like you know everything. You see what I'm saying? Like that, the top of your head, that's, yeah, if you get to the heart of the matter, or to the heart of oneself, the heart is the center, not the head. So it's like thinking the sun revolves around the earth instead of the earth revolving around the sun. We have the wrong, I believe there's this completely wrong idea of consciousness originating from the brain.
The Dalai Lama speaks about consciousness as being defined as a light. And in your own articles and in your writing, you quoting from your article, you state, "The Dalai Lama most clearly equates consciousness with light. Consciousness is defined as that which is luminous and knowing." Now, when you talk about light, are you talking about the same light that we're all familiar with, like light from an incandescent bulb, or are you talking about a different kind of light?
I am talking about light as we're familiar with, even though in ways we don't really understand that ordinary light. But in a way, I'm saying there is an interior light source. And mystics compare the self within the heart to the sun, which they say is inherently self-illuminating. Okay, so it's like there's this point source of supernal or spiritual light within the heart, and that brings life and consciousness into the body. So I am meaning light literally. I'm saying there's a science to this inner light. But to understand what light is, in modern physics, it's very complicated to understand the newest models of light and higher dimensions and such.
Well, even physicists don't understand it. I mean,
they don't. Exactly.
They've been in a quandary over it for years, and even now in quantum physics, you know, there's still a problem. Once you start doing some experimenting and find out that light, in fact, is both a particle and a wave, how do you find a practical use for that kind of result? You know, it leads you in a bit of a quandary as to what even light is, and do the physicists know what they're talking about? Well, getting into quantum physics, you took a little bit of a poke at a Scientific American illustrator. Matter of fact, the name of the article is "Are You a Hologram?" And you went at great length to kind of discuss why the illustrator puts the brain
as the center of the hologram.
You different conclusion. What is that?
The point I'm making is they're trying to illustrate how a human being...
Christopher?
Yes? They're trying to illustrate how a human being might be a hologram of the whole, and yet they assume that hologram is centered around the brain in the head, whereas I would say you take a human being as a whole, the center is the heart. Hologram should be around the whole of the individual. Nevin?
Okay, when we actually do studies, I'm here.
Okay, sorry.
We're having a sound problem or what?
Yeah, it sounded a bit. I missed part of what you said.
I think. But we'll keep struggling along here.
Okay.
Okay, you arrive at a conclusion that the heart is the true center of the human being, and I understand that. Now, let's step back. I'm going to play devil's advocate here. If, in fact, you stimulate the brain, one of the things that occurs is you do get past memories. No such thing occurs with a scientific investigation of the heart. In other words, stimulation of the heart does not direct electrical stimulation does not produce those kind of memories. How could you possibly demonstrate what you're suggesting in some sort of scientific manner?
A very interesting question. And see, if you have past memories, you have consciousness of the memories. Now, I'm not saying that memories aren't encoded neurologically. I agree that they are. Some of different memories, I think, are localized in different parts of us. But the consciousness is something different than the memories. You see, the consciousness is the awareness of the memory. So the fact that neurons represent memories doesn't mean that that explains the consciousness.
No, it doesn't at all, and that's the, exactly
yeah.
the point
it's
I
that
wanted
distinction
to get to.
That's so critical, yeah.
And it is so important for everyone to understand that. You see, it's just assumed, Christopher, that because that emerges, therefore that must be the source of consciousness. One has nothing, absolutely nothing to do with the other. It's simply an experiment which demonstrates, yeah, this occurred. But to go any further than that, you can't. But scientists, like everyone else, do want to make those leaps in terms of induction, and they make a conclusion. In fact, there is absolutely no evidence to suggest that even the brain itself is a storehouse, other than because you stimulate it, you get something from it. But also, the brain could very well be like a radio. You stimulate it, it passes through different centers, possibly to the heart, and onward and upward into another dimensional area in which information is handed down. So, you know, the scientists could spend eternity looking for something inside the brain. But in fact, the only thing that they can demonstrate is that when you stimulate it, you get a memory. Another good example is I defy any scientist to show me in a microscope pain. You know, where is pain? You know, where does it come from? Well, you can't put pain under a microscope. All we know is that it exists, and that most likely the center of consciousness is what's fostering it. But you can't actually view it, you can't find it, so you have to generalize about it.
See, mystics in the way they compare consciousness with light, okay? So imagine in the space around you, there's light there, and you might be aware of different objects and people, and the light illuminates all these different objects. Well, I'm saying there's an inner light that can illuminate your mind or illuminate your emotions so that you can be conscious of feelings, you can be conscious of sensations, you can be conscious of desires. But the consciousness is something different than thinking, feeling, and sensation. See, whereas in Western psychology, they confused consciousness with thinking and feeling. And I'm saying, no, consciousness is light. And the thinking and feeling and sensation, those are some of the things you can be conscious of. They're the objects of consciousness, but not the consciousness itself.
Yeah, it's a little analogy to that. And this might be a kind of a far-out analogy, but when we take a measurement of personality, we're not actually measuring personality. We're measuring responses on a piece of paper.
Yeah.
As to what personality is, we may never know. All we know is what responses a person made on a piece of paper.
Yeah, and then we kind of forget that, and we think that we've measured personality, but in a way, exactly as you've said, we haven't really. We've reified it. Yeah.
No, not at all. And the same thing even in intelligence testing. There's another whole area that has absolutely nothing to do with innate intelligence. It's measuring achievement in school. And yet, you know, it goes out over the airwaves as this, oh, yeah, we actually measured intelligence as if it were something you could put under a microscope. It's just not there. Well, Christopher, also within your writings, you go in great detail about Carl Sagan. And I want to make a quote from one of your articles here. Carl Sagan, a real scientist, had already declared in 1980 that the cerebral cortex is where matter is transformed into consciousness. And everyone who writes a book on human consciousness has been putting brains and heads on the book covers for over 50 years. Now, when you said a real scientist, you've taken a heck of a poke. And so why don't you explain a little bit of the sarcasm besides the conclusion?
Well, back in that period in the 1980s, I read Sagan's Broca's Brain, and he had a number of lectures in that. One was called a Sunday Sermon, where he talked about science and the issue of the existence of God. And he made the comment, as science advances, there's less and less for God to do. Okay, so in my writing, I take Sagan on as a foil who kind of represents a materialist scientist viewpoint that science is explaining everything in life and there's less and less for God to do. And then I try to turn it around and show how foolish that is. and that really, as science has advanced, we're faced with more and more fundamental enigmas and more mysterious nature of life, that really there's more and more for God to do. But when Sagan, and then it comes to the issue of consciousness, like Sagan, he declares the cerebral cortex produces consciousness. So he solves this fundamental enigma with a hop, a skip, and a jump, and jumps
it was a major skip and jump. Absolutely. I mean, he did exactly what he is accused all these spiritual people of doing. He
That's terrible. Exactly so. Exactly. Yeah. So that's what I do in taking apart Sagan in my work. Like, he'll talk about evidence for reincarnation, and then he mentioned in one article, Ian Stevenson's work. And then Sagan says, but it could have been that the child heard stories. And then because he's able to offer a rational expiation, that is supposed to undermine everything Stevenson studied and researched. And he obviously looked at that. You see, it's like the person who thinks they're so rational and they embody science, they're so superficial when it comes to looking at the profound questions involved in these areas of paranormal phenomena and consciousness and so on.
It becomes superficial, Christopher, because they use superficial methods. Maybe the most humorous aspect to it is that Carl Sagan himself is viewed somewhat as godlike within the area of science. And so when he because he's able to point out how something might occur, it becomes part of the gospel.
Yeah.
Absolutely absurd.
Yeah, and it's quite fanciful. And it's as if all these people in these other areas aren't also serious research scientists who know how to have experimental controls and so on. Yeah, so
okay.
It's kind of that superficial portrayal of science.
All right, now the people listening to this show, one of the things that is going to happen is they're going to say to themselves, now wait a minute, if my consciousness is in fact part of my heart, how come I seem to hear myself think inside my skull?
Well, I'm saying that consciousness originates from the heart, but what I explain is it is connected to the blood and the oxygenation of the body. So although consciousness originates from the heart, it can spread all through the body. Like if I bring my attention to my feet, within a few moments, my feet get warm because my blood flow increases to my feet. Okay, just by bringing my consciousness to my feet, the blood flows there. Okay, and I feel as though I'm in my feet. Now, the modern psychologist thinks your awareness of being in your feet, he thinks it's only up in your head. Okay, or suppose you eat a big meal and your blood flows to your stomach. And I would say, in a way, your consciousness is in your abdomen. And it feels like that. It feels like your consciousness is in your gut. But now the scientist thinks all consciousness is up in the head. But I'm saying, no, it's related to blood flow. You can be conscious in your abdomen. When you're sexually aroused, the blood flow is to the genitals.
This is a very extremely important point. Folks, when Christopher is talking about blood flow, you need to understand that this is a heavily investigated area in the field of psychology, especially in terms of biofeedback. And when people do concentrate, they do, in fact, increase blood flow. As an offshoot of one experiment, migraine headaches were found to be lessened simply by a person concentrating on heating the temperature in their hand. So there is a lot to be said for what Christopher is saying, that the blood flow is, in fact, a pathway for many, many things.
Yes, it's very interesting. Even in modern brain research, when scientists are trying to show what part of the cortex are responsible for different cognitive abilities, what they really monitor is blood flow. And where the blood flows, they know that that's a part of the cortex involved in that experience. But they don't think the blood flow has anything to do with the cortical activity. So I'm saying the consciousness is connected to blood flow. So you do a particular kind of arithmetic problem, the blood flows up to your parietal lobe, and you're conscious in your parietal lobe. But you eat a big meal, your consciousness flows into your stomach, and you feel conscious in your stomach. You see, it's a different... Modern scientists think all of awareness is up in the head. The more you think about it, you realize, in a way, how ridiculous that is. Because inwardly, we don't experience ourselves like that. We experience ourselves being in ourself fully. Most people think you can be conscious of your whole body at once.
I had that as a personal experience, Christopher, and it occurred in a high-risk area that I was in. I had became a really good downhill skier, and I got to a point, and I remember it clearly, one day, on one particular run where everything achieved balance and I was no longer inside my head. I felt my entire being as one with that snow and those skis traveling at 35, 40 miles an hour. It only lasted, you know, a few seconds, but at that point in time, I recognized my consciousness throughout my whole physical self and tied to the earth beneath me.
Yes. See, I believe consciousness is even within space around us. I don't believe our awareness is simply confined to what we can see of the body, but we can, it's around us as part of the aura. Consciousness can be of space around us. So it's not simply limited even to the body.
You eventually come up with some terms where you kind of play a few games with words, the personal pronoun I and the noun of eyes. You want to get into a little bit of that? Because when people come across it, they're going to get confused in the articles.
Okay, well, there's different ways I talk about it, different points. But one concept is, Gurdjieff says people think they have one eye, like a capital I. But really, most human beings have many little eyes. Like I this, I that, I whatever. And we have all these little eyes, and most people don't know real I. Okay? So in a way, I believe we have to wake up to acquire and realize real I. So and then the other way of talking about eyes is, in my view, we all originate out of these deep grounds of being, and there's that infinite being, or what people might call God, that lives through us all. We're all this higher dimensional being, and we are all eyes, E-Y-E-S, of that, meaning God. So we all, like God, experiences through all of us, so we are all eyes of that. So partly my writing plays on those concepts at different points.
I want to jump now, Christopher. I think we've covered the topic fairly well of the heart being the center of consciousness. I want to move on to something most people are going to be very familiar with. It's a movie, What the Bleep Do We Know? Now, Christopher, you took some heavy-duty pokes at this movie, and everyone seems to assume that this is a great portrayal of human consciousness and what we are about. So why don't you explain to the audience how you felt about the movie? And you say it's completely erroneous to our understanding of the nature of human beings. So give us your explanation as to where did the movie go wrong?
Okay, once again, they don't deal with this issue of what is the nature of consciousness. And once again, they assume that it's produced by the mind or the brain in the head. Okay, so the movie's implicitly based on the head doctrine. There's no mention of the heart in the whole movie. Even when they talk about emotions, they're talking about the limbic system and neuropeptides. Okay, but how many people go home and say, sweetheart, I love you with all my limbic system. I love you with all my head. They never mention the heart. There's no, and even in terms of human transformation, it's the awakening of the human heart, which is the next stage in human evolution. And it's regarded as the fourth chakra, if you're familiar with those. Yeah, so that is the first level of awakening, is the opening of the heart chakra. But a lot of New Age people think everything is up in the mind. And then they say, oh, left brain, right brain. Your mystical experience is in your right brain and your rational experience is in your left brain. But that's completely fanciful. So in the movie, there it was their treatment of consciousness, the lack of any understanding of the heart, and other complicated things a bit around the physics, which I think they're missing the most important ideas in quantum physics that support mystical concepts.
Well, I want to play the devil's advocate again. Why pick on one particular movie? I mean, Hollywood puts out a lot of movies, and as far as obscuring the truth, I can't think of anything more obscuring than the Christian Bible.
Well, I wouldn't want to argue that, but I picked on that movie. In a way, it's the first of a new genre of movie that's attempting to explore these issues of the soul and consciousness and so on. So really, there's no other movie to pick on. I'll pick on others.
You picked on the one thing that was there.
Yeah.
Okay. That's a legitimate response. It really is. Okay, now, in some of your writings, you talk a lot about Mark Cummings. Who is he, and how does his work influence yours?
Well, I met Mark this year at a conference in Montreal, and Mark's a physicist, and he lives on the west coast of the States, and he's one of the world's foremost experts on zero-point technologies and free energy movement, and he is interested in he's interested in the synthesis of mystical and scientific viewpoints. And I attended Mark's lecture, and like, oh, wow, he was taught, of anyone's work I know, his was most similar to my own and complemented what I was saying. Like, he talked a lot about the nature of light and consciousness and light and what is the actual physics of light and how this could be so and so on. And he talked about the heart, and so our work is very similar in many ways. So, and then there were things in my work that he lacked, as I saw it, in his own work. So we've kind of discussed perhaps collaborating on some work.
Are you doing that now, Christopher? Are you and Mark collaborating on any particular writing?
Well, we haven't been actually because I just got back. I traveled across Canada in my van and traveled for 2 months and have just gotten back, and I'm needing to complete other work. So the timing hasn't yet been right, and I think Mark will likely be back at the conference in the spring in Montreal again. So I think we'll need to pursue it at a later point. And also, I know Mark's been very busy with all his different projects there in the States.
What kind of, you mentioned traveling around in a van. It reminds me of myself a long, long time ago, riding around in a van. What kinds of experiences did you have on your trip?
Some quite magical experience. One of them, we picked up a hitchhiker, a native Canadian man up in the north end of Vancouver Island, and he said, oh, he had a place where he picks eagle feathers and asked if we wanted to go out and pick eagle feathers. And, oh, yeah, let's do that. So we went back into the woods with him. And then it was a place where they make fertilizer out of salmon parts. And then all of a sudden we find ourselves surrounded by about 10 bears, all big black bears. It was quite a magical experience. And it was interesting. You talk out loud to bears. It helps keep them away. So that was just one experience. Another was seeing whales. And
One of the major areas that you start getting into is you get involved in a discussion of mind, spirit, and soul. And frankly, this is a really difficult terminology. You know, the term psychology, it was originally used to describe the soul, whatever that is. And in fact, it comes from a Greek word which means the breath or the soul. Christopher, how would you distinguish those three things, mind, spirit, and soul? Or is there a distinction from your point of view?
Well, I would usually distinguish between body, soul, and spirit. But to look at that, in a way, I would say body is the material aspect And the spiritual aspect is on the spiritual plane. But the spirit ensouls the human being. So the soul is what connects the body to spirit. So the spirit which ensouls the body. So in a human being, you are ensouled through your breath and through the oxygenation of your blood. That brings the spiritual life down into the material body. So your soul connects spirit to the body.
Well, but you have made a great case for the development of spiritual psychology itself. In fact, possibly as a study course in university systems, which, by the way, the University of Santa Monica does have a master's degree in spiritual psychology.
Oh, excellent.
Gary's, yeah.
Excellent. That's so important. We have to, that has to be made available to people.
Well, I think that what you experienced and what I also experienced 30, 40 years ago, it is very different today. Gary Zukav made a plea a long time ago in his book, Seed of the Soul, for the development of spiritual psychology. But at the time, I think it also fell on a lot of deaf ears.
Yeah.
However, today, I think it's very different. One of the people that you don't mention anywhere that I could find on your website is Carl Jung. And yet, to me, he seems to have been one of the individuals who was, in fact, a borderline spiritual psychologist. Can you give us a few comments? Definitely.
And I have studied Jung's work and used to teach it in my courses. And I consider I study the esoteric mystical teachings. And Jung is bordering on it, but I would say that the Vedic teachings, the Kabbalah, Gurdjieff, like these are more true esoteric psychologies. Jung, there's a lot of value in his work, but he doesn't elaborate the heart doctrine as an instance.
No.
Whereas all these other mystics, I would say that is in all, it's in Sufism, Hinduism, Christianity, Kabbalah, the heart doctrine. All the mystics emphasize the heart. Jung,
I think what you're saying is that if Carl Jung had talked about consciousness as being centered in the heart, you might be spending more time discussing Carl Jung. Is that right?
Well, I would look at that more. I mean, as it is, I've studied Jung's work quite a bit, and there's a lot of value in there, and his study of symbols and so on is valuable. Yeah.
Let's jump to microcosm, macrocosm. Now, Christopher, that's a difficult read at best, and it takes a lot of fortitude to go in search of that knowledge. Now, there is a statement in there that I'm not really sure who said it, but I want to read it to the audience. It comes in four levels, so I'm going to read all four of them. And it's descriptive of our search for knowing who we are. One, ignorant man goes no further than the concept of God as an old man with a long beard who sat on a golden throne and gave orders for creation. Two, the scientist will go back a little further before he is compelled to draw a veil called the ether. Three, the philosopher will go yet further before he draws a veil called the absolute. Four, the initiate will go back furthest of all because he has learned to do his thinking in symbols. And symbols are to the mind what tools are to the hand, an extended application of its power. Now, Christopher, in all of this, what you're saying is that the person who knows least is most likely to achieve most. Is that right?
Were there complex things here? In a way, yes. It's like I think ordinarily we're so filled with false knowledge that the more we strip away and living in the unknowing, then we're closer to truth. So that's one aspect in which that's true. Another thing, that quotation is from a book by Dion Fortune talking about Kabbalah. Okay, and Kabbalah is this, as you know, this kind of ancient Jewish mystical symbol. And that the metaphysics of Kabbalah is so profound as a mathematical model of the universe. But so he's talking about how the mystic can go furthest because he thinks in terms of symbols. So symbols, something like the tree of life, encapsulates so much profound knowledge in such a simple way if you know how to read and interpret the symbol.
Well, when you talk about the Tree of Life, that in itself is extremely complicated. I mean, the Kabbalah itself seems to be primarily a manual of the structure of existence itself, and it attempts to explain that which defies comprehension, a sort of, exploratory explanation of esoteric conundrums. Now, a wonderful description of this difficulty from your website is, quote, "The mind can no more grasp transcendental philosophy than the eye can see music." Absolutely wonderful. I mean, I came across that and I can't get it in my head because it is so descriptive.
To understand esoteric knowledge, it's like you can go so far with the mind, but then you need, and you would have direct experiences of things. And that's what we need, is a direct experience, mystical experiences that guide and inform us. That mind has to kind of climb along to kind of come to the point where you might realize things directly through your own mystical experience.
Well, when you get into a discussion on the Kabbalah, the explanation of the nature of man seems to suggest that existence in human form is simply a different perceptual view of that which is divine. Am I correct in the conclusion of what you're saying?
I'm not sure. The way I would describe it is we come down out of higher dimensional space, and in Kabbalah, there are four worlds: emanation, creation, formation, and world made. And I believe similarly we have a divine nature, a spiritual nature, a soul nature, and a material body. We live in those four worlds all simultaneously, one within the other. So Kabbalah is a profound symbol to depict these higher dimensions.
Well, let's get into the Tree of Life for a minute here. I'm just going to ask you one straightforward question. What is it, the Tree of Life? How is it used?
Oh, okay. It's so complicated. Okay, it has 10 sephira, or spheres, and they're on three pillars. The three in the supernal triad, the three at the top, that represents the supernal triad, or the threefold nature of God. And the seven below are the seven created by the three above. So the three and the seven give you 10. Now there's all, when creation happens, a line of light descends down through the Tree of Life, breaking symmetries in higher dimensions. And that creates different worlds which materialize out of the ethers as these symmetries are broken. Now, I look at Kabbalah and trying to relate it to physics. Other people have other approaches to Kabbalistic study. But in a way, it's a model of higher dimensional space and the forces of creation.
Well, it sounds as if I got this right, that the Tree of Life is a roadmap of God. Is that what it might be?
It's described, yeah, as a model of the universe. It's a mathematical model of the universe, the macrocosm, mm-hmm. and a model of an individual human being, the microcosm.
Now, according to the Kabbalah, the creation process involves the descent of supernal light within the realm of the void of non-being. Now, you're saying that this light is, in fact, the same as the light that we understand coming from light bulbs. Is that correct?
Well, no, that's external light, whereas you have to understand the higher dimensional nature of light. Like, divine light is different than the light we have that radiated from an electric light bulb in terms of frequency of vibrations. I mean, one is in the visible light spectrum, and the other is up at levels of Planckian units. So it's down in deep space. It exists at a different level of existence, unmanifest in the physical world.
Christopher, we have less than 1 minute to go. What would you like your concluding remarks to be to the audience? Go for it.
Learn to live in the light. Explore the dimensions of your heart.
wonderful.
We need to look at mystical and spiritual teachings. We need to bring them into the educational system and into the discourse of science. We need to look at all these paranormal phenomena from a scientific viewpoint. There's other levels of reality, and there's overwhelming evidence for these phenomena. So we have to be brave instead of hiding behind Darwinianism, and we have to look into the psychology of the soul and spirit.
There's a very important term there, folks, brave. And let me tell you, what Dr. Holmes did over his life took a lot of brave attitude on his part. A coward could not do what he has done. Remember, this man had to climb past those barriers, those academic barriers, and believe me, folks, I know them well. Christopher, thank you so much for coming on our show tonight. It was absolutely marvelous. This hour went by so quickly.
Yeah, didn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, it really did.
Yeah.
My producer is prompting me over here. He wants to keep going, but I can't. I've got to get some other things done. Christopher, if you ever get to a point where you can come up with a grant for us to travel to the Far East, I would love to go there with you. I'll carry your baggage for you if you want.
I'll carry yours.
Thank you again, Christopher, and good night to you. And that, folks, ends our show for tonight. Again, it was a fascinating journey into the realms of forbidden knowledge, brought to us by Dr. Christopher Holmes. Until next week, until next time, this is Nevin Campanella wishing all of you health, happiness, and a safe journey on your chosen path. Good night.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.